It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 243, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, tech travel, security bloops, getting the news, rewriting COBOL.
Welcome back, Gary. So what most of our listeners don't know, because we didn't say anything before or while you were gone, is that Gary was off on a trip to New Zealand.
Yeah, my second trip there.
I love New Zealand. It's been a while, but absolutely love it down there. And I saw you shared some very cool pictures with some of us.
So. Yeah, I had some great hikes, backpacking in the backcountry, staying in their huts and stuff like that. But then also touring around some of the cities, got to see a lot of places like Christchurch and Dunedin and Invercargill, Wellington. It was really good. It was like a tour of all like the great cities and towns of New Zealand and some backpacking thrown in.
I'm curious.
8 years ago.
Okay.
And so it was interesting to compare, like, technology wise, there wasn't too much that had changed in terms of things. I mean, I had an iPhone back then. I have an iPhone now. I brought my MacBook back then. I have a MacBook now. But 8 years ago, Wi-Fi was really tough, a tough thing to get in New Zealand. It felt more like Europe 20 years ago. Every restaurant I went to, if they had Wi-Fi, they were very concerned as to whether or not you were a paying customer. And there were even limits. I'd like ran into like, oh, you can only use Wi-Fi for an hour, you know, that kind of thing. And this time that was like totally gone. Like Wi-Fi was everywhere. Just, you know, signs on the wall with the password, easy to get on. I never ran into anybody that seemed to be concerned about bandwidth use or anything like that. So that was kind of nice. That was like a notable change. Strangely, last time, 8 years ago when I was in New Zealand, was the very first time I ever used Apple Pay because it had just came out.
Right.
And it, you know, the US, it's like nobody was doing it yet. You know, it was like weeks had gone by. And I was actually in a gas station in New Zealand 8 years ago, just before leaving. And I noticed they had the Apple Pay symbol and I paid with Apple Pay. And I think they just installed a new little terminal there because I don't even think the person checking me out knew what it was. So this time around, of course, 8 years later, and I used Apple Pay for everything. I saw, you know, Apple, Google symbol for, you know, wireless pay. I used it everywhere. I never took cash out. So I never touched cash the entire time. I think I only took my card out a handful of times. Most of the times I paid for anything, it was just using my phone.
But why'd you grab the card?
Just for places that just didn't have, you know, like a
so
little.
They didn't have the reader, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And so it was just a few times that they were like, no, you need to use a card or whatever. So I had those as backup, but I never had to go actually back to cash to get that to work. So that was neat. I had free Wi-Fi both to and from New Zealand on Air New Zealand, which is interesting because it's the middle of the Pacific. I mean, you're basically, you take off over the Pacific from Los Angeles and you're over the Pacific until you land in Auckland, and there's nothing in sight the whole time, but I had Wi-Fi the whole time. And as you can guess, I didn't know how we got it because they don't say. They just say it's just Air New Zealand Wi-Fi. But I looked it up when I got back, and it, sure enough, as you could guess, it was Starlink.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. It worked really well. It didn't work perfect because there were times when I kind of like lost the connection a little bit. But usually, if I just like, okay, I'll take a break, and 10 minutes later go back, it worked again. So, which is a lot better than sometimes the like terrestrial, you know, Wi-Fi that we get on airplanes. Sometimes. On some of those systems, like it goes out and it's like, yeah, good luck. It's probably gone the rest of the flight.
I've always been impressed the couple of times that I've been to the Netherlands in recent years. Granted, we're going over land, but it's also the polar route. So years ago, one of the first times I took it, there was a known dead spot.
Mm-hmm.
So you're over like way northern Canada, over the top of Greenland, you're not going to get any coverage there.
Yeah.
That, of course, has gone away. But it always just, I mean, I don't know. I'm still just amazed that there's internet up there at all, right? That we're,
Yeah,
you
really.
know, I was, you know, at one point on one of my trips, I was chatting simultaneously with people on two continents because I was up in the air going from one to the other. So cool. So very cool.
And it even, you know, and I should add in that they use it. So I used it both going and coming back to do the customs immigration stuff,
Oh, right.
which I guess wasn't there. Yeah, there 8 years ago, but I've experienced it since going to Europe and everything.
Right.
So yeah, going there, they, instead of handing you a piece of paper and you fill it out, they tell you to go to this web page. And actually, there was a an app, I think, too, for New Zealand, and you could just check off a few boxes and have everything ready. And then when you showed your passport, whatever you had done immediately showed up. You were doing it online. You weren't, you know, doing it. So they knew. And the same thing coming back to the U.S., you could have certainly not done it. But there's the, what is it called? MLS or MNS? I don't know. It's an app that you can get. MCS, that's what it is. And that they encourage you to fill that, use that app and do the stuff while you're on the plane. And then it will speed you through immigration and customs when you're back in the U.S. And I did. And so that was kind of neat. I'd never had to use a piece of paper, never had to have a figure out where my pen or pencil was, like in the past, which was nice. And there was one weird thing, because I was looking, I always on these trips, I look for high tech, new uses of high tech while traveling. And then places where low tech is still there. And one place we kept running into that was funny was a majority of the places we stayed, and we stayed always in a hotel or small, I guess in the US they would call it a motel, but small places, never Airbnbs. We didn't do any Airbnbs on this trip. It was always a professional establishment. I think most of them, we got a physical metal key for the room.
An actual like insert into the hole and turn kind
Insert
of
and
key.
turn metal key. Some of
A
them, you
point.
know. Yeah, it was quick. And you know, some of them, because we stayed in these small towns where I guess crime just isn't that big of a deal. Matter of fact, it seemed to happen more often when our door actually was outside, like you stepped out of our door and you were actually outside. That's when it was the most, I think it was 100% of the time we actually had a metal key for it. And one of them even had, you know, I live in a condo building now that was once in the 1950s built as a hotel. And in the basement is some of the remnants, and there's actually the keyboard for when it was a hotel,
Oh,
and there's
right.
all the little plastic key tags from that bygone era where they used to have like the room number written on, you know, a plastic tag that went onto the key. And so I've seen those in the basement here, and one of the keys actually had that same, you know, tag type of thing on it. I thought it was just so funny. So that was kind of interesting. I mean, we did a couple of hotels we did stay in, like in Auckland and stuff, did have the little magnetic, you know, modern room keys and stuff. But it was funny that we saw that. The only other technology thing I ran into was in recent years, I've gotten away from using a digital camera, like a standalone camera. I has you know you we should just say DSLR, but it was not a DSLR, it was a mirrorless camera. And I don't really know of like a convenient way to say like camera that is not a phone camera.
Is it a what DLR, I suppose? It's, no, there's no
Yeah,
R. It's
I've
just
never
yeah.
heard anybody say DLR. They can mirrorless, so I don't know. We need a better term for that. But I've been getting away from that and using my iPhone camera. And of course, software does so much for you. It really is just point and shoot, right? And takes care of a million different things to give you decent photos. And I mean, even like night mode on the iPhone. You know, don't even worry about it. If it's dark, can you barely see? No problem. Just press the button, and then you end up with a photo that looks good. It's like, you know. So, I did get a new mirrorless camera, and but it is so new to me, and I switched from using, I was a Canon person for years, and now this is Sony, and you know, everything's a little different and all that, and I just did not have enough time to really get to know it very well until before this trip.
Did you use it at
So,
all?
yeah, I used it a lot, but I kept running into issues just because I was not familiar with it, or I'd grown used to just take the picture and it will work itself out.
Right.
And so a lot of times there were pictures that were darker than they should have been, or lighter than they should have been, like where the sky had nice white fluffy clouds against a very bright blue sky. And my picture came out where it's just a white sky, you know, because I didn't take the time to actually, you know, work with it and go out of the intelligent auto mode or the P mode and do proper things.
So I'm in the same situation a lot of the time, not because I've got a new camera, but same as you, day to day, you need a picture, grab the phone, that kind of thing. But every once in a while, I do want to grab either I have a Sony B1, I think it is, or one of my Nikons. And what I find, I've been using the Sony lately because it's much smaller, easy to just throw her in a pocket. While the quality of the pictures is typically better than my phone, admittedly. I've got a Pixel 6, so it's a few years old, but still. It's like every time I start to use it, I have to relearn. Okay, to do this on this device, this is what I need to do. To do this, I need to do that. And yeah, it's kind of sort of unfortunate. The differences, like you say, are getting smaller enough that sometimes it's just not worth the effort. It's just easier to grab the phone.
A lot, and sometimes I did just that. My biggest mistake, and fortunately I caught it after only about a dozen shots, was that I've got three dials on top, and they control various things depending upon your mode, and they're really easy, especially if you're hiking and you've got lots of
Oh, right.
equipment. Shove it, and you want to shove the camera back into the bag every moment because to protect it from elements and stuff. And I guess at some point I had the ISO on auto. So I, something I didn't have to worry about, except that going one direction from auto sets it to the lowest, and one direction from auto sets it to the highest, right? So I guess I pushed, that wheel just got pushed a little bit, and it went to 10,000 ISO. Took
Woohoo!
about 12 pictures at 10,000 ISO, which is one of the things that shooting in RAW will not let you fix. Like if it's that, it's going to be grainy. So, and you know what, I suppose there are uses for it, and actually the pictures being 60 megapixels still looked good as a full photo, but the idea is that I wanted to be able to zoom in on birds and stuff, and the ISO ruined that for me.
Try. I keep. And maybe it's just because they're tracking me because I look at them from time to time. But I have Gigapixel AI. And one of the things that it does a reasonably good job with is getting rid of grain. So if you've got a particularly grainy photo, see,
It would
I mean,
work. It would work on the photo, but unfortunately, I was at the time I was backpacking.
Sure.
I had a single lens, so I was relying on the 60 megapixels for zoom, not zoom then, but zoom now. So I'd see a bird, zoom as much as I could, take the shot. The bird's tiny, but I've got 60 megapixels to work with. I ended up with some great shots by just simply cropping, and they're like, 4 megapixel shots now or whatever, but they look great. And in this case, the ISO ruined that because it's so grainy when I just crop to that level. But anyway, it was a good example of like, this would never have happened if I was just shooting it with my iPhone. But I would have only had, technically 48 pixels, but it's really like 24 pixels. If you want to compare the Sony camera to the iPhone, it's 60 megapixels to 24 megapixels, really. The 48 megapixels are not true pixels like the Sony camera is. But it was good, and I got some good shots. And of course, I was able to get great shots of the night sky at night from the middle of
Oh, they were
nowhere,
gorgeous.
stuff
Yeah,
like that.
yeah.
Oh, it was fantastic. And I got lots of great photos that I'm still going through. And for the most part. So that's my technology report from my trip to New Zealand. So
It's
anything
funny.
happened here back in the United States while I was gone?
You know, I was thinking about it, of course, before we got together, and there's a part of me that wants to say that aside from the world being on fire, it's been there's not been a lot of activity from the players we usually talk about. Apple hasn't made any big releases, Microsoft hasn't made any big announcements, all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's still the rolling. The ongoing stuff of this update for Windows caused problems for these people, and more people than usual are complaining about this versus that. But honestly, it's been a relatively, I don't want to say quiet because that always encourages things to happen, but it's been a relatively quiet month. So it was a good month for you to be away. Now, One of the things that did come up that actually was an event while you were gone builds on something that I had planned to talk about at our last episode that got canceled at the last minute. I wrote an article about a month and a half ago on using Signal and how I am switching to Signal as my preferred, not my only, but my preferred messaging platform. And I've had a couple of people, that I communicate with switch over as well, and we're using it, and it's great. It works fine. Of course, one of the things that happened, I think it was only now like 2 or 3 weeks ago, is apparently some individuals in the US government were having a chat, and they accidentally, I'll come back to that, accidentally invited a reporter into the chat. And they were chatting about significantly sensitive things. We don't necessarily need to detail what those were, but the point is that this was a chat that should not have been in any way, shape, or form public. And they just invited the press. Now, there's a part of me in the back of my mind that says, was that accidentally on purpose? But given the players involved, I just can't see that happening. I really do think that this is a case of gross incompetence. I still don't know how you accidentally add someone to a chat. It's a proactive action. You either have a contact that you know by name and you're adding them, or you have a phone number that you got from somewhere that you are entering. And even if you mistype the phone number, the chances of it being a specific reporter at a specific publication
That you've talked to before, yeah.
is kind of improbable. So honestly, I'm not really sure what happened. But one of the things that naturally, of course, people come to my article on Signal and say, well, here, ha ha ha, look what happened. And indeed, my comment on that is simply that no technology is going to protect you from incompetence. You can use the most secure software in the world, whatever that might be, improperly, and have exactly this kind of scenario come through. Signal, I'm still Signal's great.
Yeah, there's
It's
really
it's.
nothing. There's no way to blame Signal for this. It's not like something
Nope.
didn't work right. It worked exactly to exactly what they.
Now, one of the very common refrains that I got on the original article before this happened was that, well, the government's already monitoring everything you're doing on your phone. So since you have to be able to see it on your phone, well, then it's being slurped up by the government, by Apple or Google, by AI companies, by somebody, right? So there is the reaction that I got to that original article was that, man, there's a lot of paranoia out there right now, which I find kind of interesting in that they're complaining about how everybody's watching us and slurping up all our data, even the stuff that we're doing with these supposedly secure apps. And yet, the tools that they're using to make these complaints are public. They're with the same companies that they're complaining about. I mean, if you're complaining about Google, why do you have a YouTube account? That kind of thing comes to mind. So it was interesting to just sort of see that reaction kind of surprised me, the level of paranoia and expectation that our devices are, by definition, already compromised the moment we turn them on, is kind of surprising. I don't know if you hear that from folks or not, but I sure did on this one.
Oh no. I'm familiar with that. For me, one of the main things of the story that I think is interesting is that people are focusing on, there's actually three aspects to it, and and people are focusing on the two that don't really matter too much. One is that the reporter was invited by accident, which I think doesn't matter much at all because they shouldn't have been on Signal in the first place, right? But two is the security, like you're saying, Like, how secure is it? Because it's not, I mean, doesn't the Department of Defense have something internal that's way more secure than using, an app by some private company?
A public app, I would hope so, right?
Okay. But these things don't, these things are simply, yeah, they shouldn't have been on Signal, should have been somewhere else. But the third thing is the Signal has a particular feature that makes it so that they were actually breaking the law. And that feature is that you could have it automatically erase the messages. And they actually had it set to automatically erase the messages in that that chat after 1 week. But there are rules about official government correspondence,
Right.
and no doubt this was a bunch of high-profile people talking about a government military, activity. And they had it set to basically be like, we're going to talk about it, and then in a week, it's gone forever. And it doesn't get saved, and it doesn't go into, the records and all that stuff.
Right.
And
Right.
that should have been the, even if they were like not that smart and thinking that this was secure and that they couldn't possibly accidentally invite somebody they shouldn't have, they still should have been like, oh, we're not supposed to be doing this.
You know, I mean, we're verging on politics here, but
Yeah.
right now the sense I get is that we're not supposed to do this
Yeah.
is not a phrase that's being paid attention to very much. It's very
Exactly.
possible that they understood completely what
Yeah.
was going on and they decided that they were above having to do that. Fortunately, I'm glad that it was a week because it gave that reporter a week to scrape everything, basically collect everything and preserve it for much longer, which of course is one of the things that I absolutely say about Signal and any app you're communicating with someone else on. If they can see it, they can save it. So if you've got somebody untrustworthy in the conversation, it's no longer a secure conversation.
Yeah, and there is one other, there's a benefit to the entire thing, a bright side, a silver lining, if you will, is that I love emoji because I believe in the evolution of language, and I believe that sometimes text communication can be misconstrued because you don't see facial expressions and gestures and all that.
Agreed.
And emoji kind of fills a little bit of that in, like I'm going to put little colorful pictures to indicate that, oh, I mean this jokingly, or I, whatever it is. I love emoji. I talk about emoji. I do videos on emoji all the time, and I get comments back saying, "Why are you bothering with this? This is just for kids." And now I can point to the fact I could say kids and high-ranking government officials talking about military operations. So it gives me a good comeback.
There you go. Yeah,
Yeah.
I actually, to be honest, I haven't bothered to even look at the conversation, so I have no idea how thoroughly emojis were being used in the conversation, but it doesn't surprise me in the least.
Yeah.
And I'll actually have something to say about emoji a little later on too.
Yep. Okay.
So anyway,
Yeah.
yeah, so Signal, I suppose, would probably be the single biggest thing that kind of sort of
Oh,
happened
sure. Tech-wise, yeah.
while you were out and about. One of the other things we were going to talk about last episode that didn't happen is the fact that Apple was pulling their data protection tool after the UK government suggested that they should have access to everybody's encrypted data, even people who aren't in the UK, which I think is, one of those things that just seemed like a gross, gross overreach. I'm curious as to what your thoughts on all that were, since clearly it affects, your area of technology dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, Apple and the UK have been in kind of a fight over this. Apple is, or the UK definitely, we've both been there. You find security cameras everywhere, right? Privacy is kind of like a slightly different level in the UK than it is in the US. And their ability to get like records and things from people, from, the government, it's different. They think about it differently there. Apple, of course, introduced this advanced data protection stuff pretty recently, I guess last year or something like that. Last year or the year before? Yeah, I think it was last year. So the funny thing is, of course, people complaining about the advanced data protection being removed in the UK, it's like, okay, so now, as of now, things are just like they had been for a long time, right? It's like don't, it, and probably most people complaining about it hadn't even turned it on. So,
And it is something to turn on. To be clear, it is something you have to turn on,
yes.
and it is something that encrypts your data in such a way that Apple can't see it. Only you have the
More of
key.
it. Yeah, I mean, some of it already is that way by default, but so more of it becomes that way.
Okay.
And the downside is the reason most normal users do not turn it on is if you really screw up and you lose your password you got a new cell phone with a new number and now the two factor, it all doesn't work. In the past, there are certain things you can go and work with Apple to get back. And they have other ways to do it, which usually involve delays. You use your credit card, you talk to them, you confirm you're you. There's like a 7-day wait, there's a lot of back and forth, and you can get your precious photos back, that kind of thing. More stuff goes behind the complete encryption where Apple can't do it, just cannot do it. You've turned on advanced data protection. Now, these things, I forget which things they are, photos, notes, other things, now suddenly are to the point where Apple does not have the ability to recover those for you. And so a lot of people see that message, it's explaining what's going to happen, and they chicken out, right? They're like, oh boy, oh my goodness. And so, yeah, so that's why most people don't have it turned on or whatever. Now, it's not going to end here, right? Because UK wants all this, access to everything, and Apple's going to have to decide. And Apple now is like kind of relying on courts and stuff to be like, they challenge it and UK comes back and how long can we put this off kind of thing. But eventually, if the UK does win out and says, well, by law, we need to have this access, it'll be interesting to see what Apple does at some point. If it has to roll back to make it easier for there to be a back door beyond what was even there previously.
Well, so by not enabling this feature in the UK right now,
Yeah.
isn't the current situation exactly what the UK government wants?
No, they want more access, I believe. I mean, I think eventually, because there's stuff that even without advanced data protection, you Apple can't get,
Okay.
right? Apple just cannot get it for you. So if you got to, I don't recall which things between notes, reminders, calendar events, emails, and all that stuff. I don't remember which things are completely encrypted and owned by you. But if you were to try to recover stuff using Apple as like you're only, begging them for recovery, there are certain things they'd be able to get for you, and certain things they would just say, well, you don't have that anymore. It's gone. And the UK would probably want Apple to roll that back so that they do have a key
Right.
so that the government can then go and say, we have a warrant for this person's data, this person's whatever it is, and we can get to that. And Apple's, going to fight them on it, or is probably fighting them on it, and we will never see the end of it. It's going to be back and forth.
What's frustrating, there's two sides to it. One is it is an incredibly strong argument for, come on, people, back up your data yourself.
Certainly.
Right. If you've got it all in iCloud and your iCloud goes away, make sure you've got a copy somewhere else. That's pretty straightforward. And I always tell people to, if you've got encrypted data somewhere, back it up in unencrypted form. So you're not at risk of having your encryption fail on you when you need it most. But the other part of it is that, okay, great. And what's the phrase? If encryption is outlawed, only outlaws will use encryption.
Right, yeah.
It's one of those things where, okay, great. Apple's not going to encrypt this thing for me in a way that can't be exposed. I'll encrypt it myself. For the people that are technical enough to know it, which a lot of cyber criminals, for lack of a better term, definitely are. They're going to encrypt things with tools that can't be easily cracked, therefore which there is no backdoor and for which they really don't care. It seems like one of those unending battles. You're right. The government wants something and they believe that because they're the government, they deserve that something, even though it's either technologically not possible, or philosophically, from the company's point of view, not the level of privacy we want to offer to our customers.
Yeah, it's the fight between privacy. Strangely, it's a fight between privacy and security, not computer sec your own personal security. It's like things anti-terrorism, anti-crime, that
Society.
kind of.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting. And I do think that I think the UK government kind of made a mistake because they asked for everything, right? They asked for your data, right? Even though you're not in the UK, the way I understand it, what the UK government was asking for would have allowed them to access your data with a warrant, which I find just mind-numbing. I mean, that just it's unbelievable that they would go that far. But I think that was a huge mistake, and I think that's a lot of what got a lot of attention on the issue. I also think that other companies are going to be fi facing it. Anybody that does cloud storage is going to be facing it. And yeah, everybody that knows what they're doing is going to not trust the cloud storage to encrypt things for them and do it themselves. So we'll see.
See another story. Well, kind of not a, really a story, but something I noticed even before I left on my trip was I, trying to keep track of news. Since the last election, I've kind of sworn off TV news and other kinds of news, and been very focused on news that you take in at your own pace, as opposed to being fed to you at a steady pace. In other words, reading. As opposed to listening or watching,
What a
right?
concept.
It was just it's a thing I'm trying to do. I thought about it and I'm trying to do it. So reading lots of articles and trying to stay up with the news by reading only. And the interesting thing I discovered was that recently it seems like it, previously there had been a different types of news like sports, weather, and all that. There's political news, it's one type of news. There's tech news. The interesting thing is just trying to focus on tech news to clear my mind of politics didn't work because the tech news sites and journalists were covering lots of politics. And it got to be the point I started noticing this and trying to figure out what was going on. And sure enough, a lot of political news has been reported in what had been tech news sources, places like Wired, places like The Verge. A new place that I discovered, like 404 Media, I had noticed that they were covering lots of politics, but it wasn't like they were just covering pure politics. The articles did have a tech aspect to it, and it occurred to me that so much in politics now is tech related. I have a degree in journalism, and for a short time, I thought I might be like a journalist, like, actually like covering politics and stuff instead of getting into technology. And so back when I was really into it, and when I would read like news several newspapers a day and was following everything, political news was political news, and tech news didn't exist really yet, and it was kind of new. But there wasn't much technology in all this stuff, right? It was more social issues and law and all that. Now, so much we have to deal with is tech oriented, like even the Doge stuff. Which is like a huge political story in the US of Elon Musk and his buddies going around to different departments and laying people off and things like that. I mean, it's very tech-based. I mean, he constantly talks about use of AI, about just taking care of better technology solutions, replacing people with with technology and all this. And then accessing databases, right? Database access and all this. So, of course, those technology journalists are going to be covering all this stuff because that's really it fits in with them. But it is interesting how like how little political news I saw that was I did not already read what after reading my tech news. It was all
It's
covered.
I ran across an article, and I honestly I wish I remembered where, that was talking about sources of accurate information. I don't want to say unbiased, but basically, accurate information. And there were a lot of sources that you would recognize without hesitation. I think things like Wired, 404, The Verge, and so forth were probably listed on there. I'll talk about 404 in a second. The one that surprised me, just surprised the heck out of me, was Teen Vogue. And I say that both with a mixture of surprise and almost gratitude, because let's face it, that audience needs good information. So I'm kind of glad to see that as being, potentially a source of objective information. 404 Media was started, what, I think just a year or two ago. And they were like a handful. I think there's like four, six people
Yeah.
behind it. And they set up their own media organization specifically for doing it, the independent journalism that they really wanted to do and felt they couldn't at the various places they were. I've been a subscriber since the start, and yeah, it's been really, really, there's really good stuff there. Sometimes they go, deep into politics, which I tend to not pay attention to. But of course, like you say, there's a lot of overlap right now between politics and tech, and it's important.
Yeah, I it's funny you mentioned Vogue because having grown up primarily in the 80s and everything like that, I still when I think of Vogue magazine, I think of fashion, a fashion magazine. And it obviously is more than that. And it was more than that a long time ago too, because I saw the recent movie Lee, which is was about the World War II photojournalist Lee Miller. Who played by Kate Winslet, and it was an interesting movie, of course, because she was a female journalist who was trying to cover World War II using her camera, and in the end, she photographed some of the horrors of war, and really wanted to show, including Holocaust photos and all, and at the end of the war, really wanted people to see this stuff, and she was publishing her stuff in the UK, not the US. I think Vogue in the UK was like, no, the war's over. We want to move on. We're not publishing your photos. And what saved everything was the fact that they sent them on to the US, and US Vogue ran her photos of the horrors of war in like the US version of Vogue in 1945, or I don't know if it was a year or two later. So it was interesting to just think that back then. He had a magazine that I always thought of as fashion, but they were putting news out there that wasn't being covered by other media. And now suddenly we have like maybe the same thing happening.
The reason that this one got my attention, though, is that this wasn't Vogue. This was
Yeah.
Teen
Teen
Vogue.
Vogue.
It's actually a subset of exactly what you're talking about to an audience we normally think of as being even less interested in what's going on politically. So anyway, I just, like I said, I thought it was kind of cool.
Well, and my one last thought about that was if tech and politics truly are overlapping news, like a news topic now, maybe it's the thing is a lot of political journalists are having trouble keeping up with the tech in their stories, whereas maybe the tech journalists are having less of a problem keeping up with the politics, or maybe they're just less afraid to actually just make assumptions and just go out there and write their stories as tech stories. And hope they get the politics right. I don't know which it is, but maybe that's just another reason why these tech sources are, tech publications seem to be covering up politics so well now. But I also mentioned the thing, with Doge going into going places. That's one of the main stories, and has to do a lot with tech. And one of the stories that came out in the last few days or week was that. Doge has been going through U.S. Social Security Administration, and they said that one of the inefficiencies there is the fact that it's a very old code base, massive code base, mostly written in COBOL.
Yay.
And they were going to basically make things more efficient by, over the next few months, rewriting the entire code base, which instantly got a reaction from a lot of people, including myself, because I mean, I started my first professional job coding would have been in the kind of late 80s. I've seen COBOL code. I actually had a job helping business majors at my college write COBOL in the computing center. And I didn't know COBOL. I just simply went as a computer science major and looked at their COBOL code and pointed out where things were wrong. So I was very kind of weirdly impressed with COBOL because I didn't know it, yet I could look at it and understand immediately what it was doing, which kind of when people, I know when people put down COBOL, There are two people, types of people that come to its defense. One is old COBOL programmers that say, hey, we got a lot done with COBOL. A lot still runs on COBOL. And the other type might be me saying, you know, there's a lot to be said for a computer language that you could just look at and know what it's doing, even if you don't know the computer language. I mean, that, you know, it shouldn't look cryptic, right? It should look pretty good. And some modern languages, like the one I'm programming in mostly now, Swift, is kind of like that. I mean, I could really look at a lot of Swift code early on and know what it was doing because of the way Swift looks, as opposed to, say, C or C++, which a lot of times would be like looking at it, and it's like, oh boy, I have no idea what's going on here until I have more context. But yeah, I also thought it's like this is a story. I relate to this. I relate to the idea of seeing old code and saying, I could just rewrite this whole thing. And what happens inevitably is you can get 90% of the way through old code, rewrite it, and be like, this is just as easy as I thought. But the last 10%,
That takes
that is
a
what kills you. And
bit
I would predict that if they really wanted to do it, which is not, this is not going to happen, if they really wanted to do it, I think in 2 or 3 months, they could be 90% done rewriting the 60 million lines of COBOL code. But the last 10% would take like 20 years before the last line of COBOL was really gone from the code. It just doesn't work like that. It's much more difficult than you think. And then also, I would predict that at some point, mired years in rewriting it, somebody would come up with the idea that they should create some sort of macro or scripting language that would speak the language of Social Security and finance and people and accounts. And then they would, if they created that, they could s use this scripting language to then s easily script a lot of what they needed to do. And they would craft it to make it work well with what they had. And in the end, they would end up recreating COBOL. And they would have basically the scripting language that looks a lot like COBOL. Because they realized that it was easier to do that instead of like going and doing it in Java or something, which is the thing
Cobol
I still
27 or
around.
something like that. Yes.
Yeah, so they would do that. But also, of course, the other thing is that I have to realize that, you know, if it's Elon Musk is behind this, what he probably envisions is taking 60 million lines of code, feeding it into an AI, and saying, rewrite this in Java. And what we get then is a reinterpretation of COBOL code in Java, which would not. Which would no, that would just, it would make things so much worse. Because right now there are probably experts at the Social Security Administration that know where in the code they can go in to fix things and do things. If they had it rewritten in Java, it probably wouldn't work. They'd probably still have to spend years getting it to work right. But then there would be tons of code that nobody would have any idea how it works.
No human has ever seen it.
No, yeah, exactly. So it's just the kind of thing where it's the whole thing's scary, but I'm not really scared because I'm sure if a project was launched to do it, it would be so mired in disaster. In fact, Social Security Administration actually had that happen. They started in 2017 or something like that with a project to rewrite all their COBOL code, and they abandoned it after a while.
Surprised. It's funny. So my relationship with COBOL was a little bit more hands-on. It's funny. When I started at Microsoft, 1983, I was offered, it was a classic bait and switch. They offered me three positions. I could work on BASIC, I could work on BASIC, or I could work on COBOL. So I said BASIC, and they said, well, how about COBOL? Says, well, maybe the other BASIC. I said, well, how about COBOL? So my first role at Microsoft was working on Microsoft's COBOL compiler and runtime. And of course, in the process, you end up learning COBOL.
Sure.
It's the way I like to classify these things. It's just another programming language.
Yeah.
Strengths, it has its weaknesses, it has its quirks, whatever. And indeed, I learned to write, I wrote code in COBOL. In fact, I wrote what might have been Microsoft's first bug tracking system in COBOL. Because at that time, that COBOL in particular was particularly adept at dealing with databases, and none of the other software we were using was. But you're right, rewriting anything of any significance Regardless of the language, regardless of whether it's COBOL or anything else, it's the sheer size of the thing that gets in the way. It just ain't going to happen. And I think the concern I have with the whole scenario is that they might throw out the original before the replacement is done. By that I mean they'll be just so tired of keeping the COBOL-based system running while they've got this new thing that's done any day. Any day it'll be ready, when of course that last 10% of the work will take 90% of the actual time. Interesting times. We shall see what happens. The one thing that actually got me and that really made me concerned about the people that are making these decisions is the fact that they were making claims that 150-year-old people were getting a Social Security. And as it turns out, those were simply people for, I think, which they did not have birth dates for, or for which some of the birthday fields were not complete, because for whatever version of COBOL they're working with, 150 years ago is the date time epoch. That's the COBOL version of year zero. So if you've got, say, zero as your age, then yeah, that means you were born 150 years ago. It doesn't mean you're 150 years old. It just means that the data wasn't entered properly. But they were taking it to mean something entirely different and using that to justify
Well,
actions.
the thing that scared me too was the fact that there was an early report when they first started talking about Social Security that they looked at the number of people in the database and it was like more than the number of people like alive or something like that. So they used it as proof. Aha, Social Security is sending checks to people that don't exist. And no, it's a database. Once you're in the Social Security database, you should be in the Social Security database forever. Like they should be able to go back and see like what checks were sent out on this day in 1973 and to who. And you can't do that unless the people are still in the database. You don't delete the person because they've died and you no longer send them a check. You
Your
need
query should say, show me the
query.
people that are alive, all right, that are nailed.
Exactly. So they have. So yeah, that's a fundamental misunderstanding. But I could see how saying that was very easy to say as a soundbite, throw it out there, and have a majority of people say, "Oh, well, this is proof positive that people are getting Social Security checks that shouldn't." And it's like, no, that's not how it works. You bought something 10 years ago, and it has an invoice number in some database, and that's still there in the database. It doesn't disappear because it was shipped to you or whatever. That's how
Proof
data.
positive that the people making the claims didn't understand what it was they were looking at. And that's probably the scariest part of all. So let's switch from scary to cool, shall we? I had a month's worth of things to choose from. It's been a month. I am pulling out the, I believe it's on Netflix show, Adolescence. Now, Adolescence is remarkable for many different things. I'm going to pull out two specifically. One is the acting is absolutely phenomenal. The primary character in the show is, I think he's a 13-year-old boy. He has never acted before. This is his first role. And it was incredible to watch. He nailed it. He absolutely nailed it. The other thing, and the other folks were also similarly awesome, but this guy gets, I guess, extra credit for it being his first role and clearly him being able to do such a good job at it. The other thing that's made more press about this particular show is there are only four episodes, but each episode is a single shot, which means they turn the camera on and an hour later they turn the camera off. And what you see for that hour is all that one recording. And doing that, it's not like it's all taking place in one location, in one set, or something like that. There is a tremendous amount of camera and scene movement. The best way I can describe it is that a lot of what they ended up having to do was boiled down to choreography between the actors, the support staff, the cameramen, everybody else that was involved in this. There's at least one scenario where They must have attached the camera to a drone, because at one point the camera, after filming for like a half an hour, whatever they're doing, they change the scene by having the camera fly over a parking lot and go to a different location where it continues to record the next scene. It's absolutely incredible, from a technological point of view. And of course, that's the kind of stuff that truly impressed me. So it's a great, it's an interesting story. It is, it focuses on teenage, male attitudes towards women is what a lot of the focus is on. There is a murder involved. It's questionable, but then it's not. There's a lot of backstory about what's going on in the school, which for us would be roughly a high school. The reason I made a quick note here, because you were talking about emoji earlier, one of the key revelations in the show was that the kids were leaving comments on Instagram photos, and those comments were emojis. The adults had no idea what those emojis really meant. And in that, there was a bit of revelation about what was really happening between the people that are involved here. So, 4 episodes, 1 hour each, adolescents, highly, highly recommended. It would not surprise me if this one walked away with a few supposed to be BAFTAs, but potentially some Emmys as well. It's very cool.
My recommendation is a little lighter, I guess. It's The Residence. I don't know if you've heard of that. It's a mystery. It's a murder mystery that takes place in the White House. So somebody is murdered in the White House during an event, and a detective is brought in. It appears to be modern day or close to it, but the detective is kind of old fashioned, and a lot of the stuff in it feels more like an Agatha Christie. Or Sherlock Holmes, even though it seems to be modern. So yeah, just trying to figure out who murdered this person that works in the White House during this state event. And yeah, it's one of those murder mysteries that's, there's a mystery, you're trying to figure out who done it, but also there's a lot of bits of humor, in it too, just the way how unusual the detective is. Now people react to her and all that stuff, so it's good. So I'm most of the way through bidding to get it on Netflix.
In terms of self-promotion, this one's a little bit different for me as well. One of the things that I found myself needing to talk while you were gone, Gary. So I ended up starting this Let's Chat series. The original pair were just me sitting in a recliner here chatting about topics. This most recent one, I went back to my desk because I wanted my microphone and my script in front of me. But it's Let's Chat about civility. And it's one of those things where in recent years, oh, I'll back up. You and I, we signed up for this. We signed up to be online publishers, and with that comes feedback. And not all feedback is positive, and some of it's downright bad, right? Uncivil, to use my term. And what I'm finding is that it feels like in the last couple of years, things have been getting a little worse. And apparently, my skin is beginning a little thinner. So I've been responding sometimes to some folks that have been leaving less than complimentary comments. Not, the disagreement kind of stuff, but the actual, you're an idiot kind of stuff. And it's an interesting thing to think about. In some ways, it feels like it's also a reflection of the times, but it's also a reflection of my, I have the right to respond, and I probably should. I've been making fun of some people, but not to them, right? It's one of those things. I think you've seen them today on YouTube. I'll take a screen grab of somebody's, off the wall, inane or stupid comment, and then make a comment of my own. But no, this is the kind of stuff where people are. I had somebody call one of my ideas asinine, is what triggered this, and I didn't want to let that sit, so I didn't. Anyway, it is on YouTube. There is a link in the show notes. There's also a copy on AskLeo.com, but I think To keep this on brand, I think the YouTube play one is the one I want to send people to. So let's chat about civility is the name of the YouTube video. It just released a couple of days ago.
Well, and I think that's definitely a topic that we'll continue to talk about, I think, in future episodes. Well, I have plenty of videos to choose from since it's been a month, but I had one that I liked myself, and it's called Working on Your Mac Without Distractions in Monk Mode. It's one of those things where I saw a some blog post about monk mode, and I didn't read past the headline. I just immediately, went and said, "What is that?" and came up with my own definition of it. And then I went and read about monk mode, and so I kind of stuck half with my own definition of what it should be, and half with like what people are talking about when they talk about monk mode. It's basically just trying to focus on a single task, like meditating, but instead of meditating, you're writing or you're drawing, if you're a graphic artist, or just editing if you're doing films. And of course, it is funny how, like, years ago, it was all the thing to talk about how to multitask, different ways to multitask. I did tons of videos how to multitask. And now I find myself more and more doing videos on how to, like, not multitask, just have one thing on your screen, concentrate on that, and get stuff done. And this, I just go throughout just a whole bunch of different tips for kind of being in that monk mode while working on your Mac.
Sounds good. I'm with you. I'm doing the same thing. I learned that one of the most valuable keystrokes in Windows is Windows key plus M, which minimizes all of your windows, all at once. And then you pick the one that you want to work on. So, all righty. Well, I think that wraps us up for another week and a successful return. As always, we are very grateful for you to listen and for you to have stuck around for a month. As always, we will see you again very soon. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/TEH243. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of Askleo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.